In Romans 12 again today for a little while. I skipped last week for a reason, and I thought I'd come back this week just for a little, just kind of re-examine the church. Sometimes you have to sit down and use a little reason and logic. And you have to ponder things in an orderly manner and then ponder them in a practical manner and find out whether or not things are really functioning as intended. So we have doctors and dentists and all that sort of thing to help us along with our physical to make sure they function as intended. My niece, who should be coming in either. I don't know if she's coming for this service or just for the 11 o'clock. Had an occasion to go to a dentist, and the dentist left one of his tools up in her tooth. And she was having all this trouble, and so she went to this other dentist, and there was this piece up in her tooth. Now, that's the first time I'd ever heard of a dentist leaving something in there. She's got a photograph of it that they took up in there. So he was supposed to be looking after her well-being, but he didn't look after it very well. Pardon?
Nice sound.
Sounds like a retirement fund.
Well, no, she was very, very gentle with the man, and she really settled for a very small amount. Anyway, the point of that is in verse 4, where it says, "We have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office. So we being many are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another." And you have to sit down and ponder that. Is there a consciousness that you are members one of another? Now, when we went into Mary Yoder's on Friday night, I went over to the book stand to see if my book was still there, and it wasn't, and I was going to show it to Sue. And so we went back to go in, and there it was. Betty had moved it, and it's right there where the people go to the hostess to seat them. And there's only two there. Did you actually sell a couple, do you think?
I have to go look. I put two back there, left three on the rack.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't see any on the rack, but there were two back, so maybe you haven't. I kind of got encouraged. Maybe they had sold them. And yesterday morning, Janice said to Jim, "Your dad put a book over there." And she said, made some comment about the book being a Christmas gift. I told her I would give her one. And she said, "Will you sign it?" I said, "Yes, so I'll make sure she gets a copy of the book." But Betty demonstrated this being members one of another. That the book, for whatever people read and look at it, the book does have purpose. And it is simple. It is not like John Owen, trying to read John Owen. Or any of those guys, or even Calvin. Calvin, you know, was very wordy, not the way John Owen was, but Calvin was a very wordy individual, as were all of those guys at that period of history. And the reality is that we live in a time that people have very, very short attention spans. And so you can't do things quite like you used to do that. You have to do it now in such a way that you hope, if I shrink this down, what they used to be able to do and take and spend an hour and a half on, now you say, can I shrink this down so where they're only going to spend 20 minutes on it? And in the book, they can go through the book quicker than 20 minutes if they just sit down and read it, if they're any kind of readers. And so you see, I have to focus on the attention span, actual attention span, and try to work with that. So I did, and this interworking where the body is always supporting each other, and Sue demonstrated that last night, not in the same way, but in the way of listening to Dougie's band, and in listening to it, making a judgment that she thought they were excellent, and then making a further judgment that she might want to connect them to this band that has national, maybe international standing, because I don't really know them, but they've been around a long time, and so I thought, well, there is, she's working to help the other people. And I would imagine if somebody told Dougie that, he probably got a little excited about it, maybe this possibility. So we have many members in one body, and all members don't have the same office, but they do have this personal care. We got a call again this morning from Rhonda. I didn't talk to her this morning. Martha did. But she called during the week, and we've been very, very busy this week since Sue and Gary have been here. And so I did finally get a call back to her for just a little bit, and she told me about the need for prayer and all. And it's you have to be careful, because sometimes people begin to wear you out. They call and call and call and call, and every time they call, it's the same thing. It never varies. It doesn't change. And so it is easy to get sort of irritated that they keep calling and keep calling, but nothing is happening. And then you have to go back and take a few minutes and go back in yourself and reflect upon your own prayer. Am I really entering into prayer for this person? I had a blessing a while back. Martha and I had a blessing, and I mentioned it on Wednesday night, and Dorothy came up to me afterwards, and she was so excited, and she said, "Jim, I've been praying that God would bless you." I don't know if her words were exactly that, but it caused her to have a great deal of excitement over the fact that she had prayed, and then I mentioned that God had blessed us in some way. So this is something to ponder. Does the church have this connectivity where there is actually the function or the relationship between the parts, that they all have the same concern one for another? And then he gets into the gifts, which we did for a second. I'm not going to spend time on verse 6, but I want to go down to verse 7. Ministry. Was sharing this with Sue and Gary just last night. I was talking about Charles Culver. Now, Betty knows Charles Culver, and Jim and Martha and Sam, but you two might not know Charles other than the guy that plows the parking lot. When Charles was 16 years old and I was at the Church of the Brethren, he came to me one day and he expressed this interest he had, this desire, more than an interest, it was a strong desire, to go into the ministry. And there were two women in the church. He had made this expression to them, and they told him he was just too dumb to go into the ministry. And that really infuriated me, and I spent time with him explaining that ministry is not necessarily teaching or preaching. There are many, many other areas of ministry, because the word ministry here is the word for where we get the word deacon. If you have a ministry, you have a deaconate. And the deacon has the responsibility of care. So one of the elements that the deacons did, the deacons had a ministry of service to the poor and to the elderly. You know, you send for the elders of the church to pray over the sick, but the deacons also had ministry in that fashion. And so when he gets into this and says ministry, it is a deaconate, and that's very expansive. Any person can serve. When you are placed into the ministry, there is a tendency on the part of some to elevate themselves above the people. And so they have this concept, they use the term reverend or whatever it might be, not in a humble fashion, but they use it to exalt themselves so that the people are looked at as inferior. The first time I went to Painesville to preach, if you go, you've been in their sanctuary, and you know that up in the front, raised way up, is a pulpit. And the first time I went there, I went, and they have another pulpit down below, and I got that pulpit, and I moved it over, and I set my Bible on it, and got my notes and set up on it, and I was getting prepared to begin the service. And one of the people walked up to me and said, you use that one up there. Now, there is logic in that that goes back in history, but I said to the guy, I said, look, I am not trying to be offensive or anything, but I feel much more comfortable at the same level as the people. And so I could stand, I stood on the floor, and ever since then, they never put my things up in the upper one. They always put the other pulpit out, and they set it there so that they now know that when I go in there, I'm going to stand on the floor because they're sitting on the floor level, and we're like at the same, there's no distinction between us other than the fact that I'm teaching and they're hopefully learning. So ministry is a humbling work of God in your life. And when you understand that the word minister means deacon, it also means servant. And the servant of the Lord, which we're told in 2 Timothy, the servant of the Lord must not strive. I have to confess to you, there are times when that's really hard. Because sometimes people, on the other side, people can make themselves so obnoxious that your natural tendency is to fight back, and then you come back to the word, and it says, but the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all people, and even those who oppose them, you teach them in humility in the hope that God will give them some kind of grace for understanding, because there's so much to understand. So in the body, we have this ministry. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, this ministry is an act of God's grace placed upon a person in whatever fashion that's going to function. Now think about this. Here we had this furnace, and the furnace needed replaced. And a year and a half ago, or whatever it was, we were informed that we were going to have to replace the furnace. And so Betty started putting it into the bulletin every week that we're going to have to replace the furnace. And if anybody wanted to take a little extra and had it and put it into the furnace fund, they could do that, place it there, and then we would gradually build up enough money so that we could buy the furnace. Then the ladies got together and said, let's sell some candy. So they started out selling the candy, and the next thing you know, they're selling the candy, and I don't know how many boxes of candy they sold, but we're getting up. We were told by the guys who told us we needed to get the furnace that the cost would be about $3,000, and so that was our target. We're looking at $3,000. Well, here comes Jennifer in one day, and she's got some money, and somebody else comes. And the next thing I ask Debbie, how much money do we have toward the furnace? And she says, we're at $2,040. Okay, we're getting in the area. We're sneaking up on it, and pretty soon we'll be able to replace that furnace. So now some more money comes in, and I don't know, I think we're up to $2,300 or something like that. And I start calling to get bids. And this fella comes in, and he goes down and looks, and he said, I can do this job for you, total job for $1,790 and $95. And we had started out at $3,000, and then we had a bid for $2,000, and this guy goes $1,795. And then he asked me this question. He said, can you pay me when we put it in? I said, yes, as a matter of fact, we've got that much. Tell you what I'll do, I'll knock another $145 off. So we got it for $1,650, which means we have a little money left over that we can put into savings and do something. But that's because the members, you see, the body, this was not one person taking money out of their pocket and putting it somewhere. This was a body of people, including the kids in the school. The SWIC kids went up and down the street knocking on doors. This was a body ministry of the people, and this was a function of grace as each one began to assume that position. And this is how it's supposed to work. So he that ministers, let him wait on his ministering, which means becomes your motive for life. What is my reason for living? My reason for living is to serve the Lord in whatever capacity he has me serve. Now, sometimes we call them jobs. Well, I have a job. Well, what do you do in your job? On your job, you serve. You serve somebody. You could be working in a factory. You could be an auto mechanic. You could be a nurse. You could be a doctor. You could run the gift shop and everything else at Mary Oder's. The only thing Betty doesn't do over there is sweep the parking lot, and I'm not too sure about that. Because the horses have a way of making them. Anyhow, she is a servant. And they used to call, I thought this was interesting, they used to call the girls who wait on the tables waitresses. Now they call them servers. They're servers. Well, that's still serving, isn't it? That's a servant. So you say, I have a job. Yeah, but in your job, you are supposed to be serving. So you have a ministry, in other words. So this is a very broad area that unfortunately has shrunk down over the years to where it only makes reference to the guy standing in the pulpit on Sunday morning or something like that. We need to get our heads straightened out. So let he that ministers wait on his ministry, or he that teaches on teaching. Now, there are two words here. The first word on teaching is didasko, and didasko just means to teach. But when it says let him wait on his teaching, it goes from didasko to didaskalia. And in didaskalia, it actually means not only the act of teaching, but the doctrine that is taught. So if you went to college to be, Jennifer went to be an RN. So when she went to college, they not only had somebody explaining to her, doing the teaching, but they had something she had to learn, which was amazing, to say, how do you learn all this stuff? So this teaching, let the teacher wait on his teaching. That means that the teacher has got to be a student. You can't teach correctly if you are not first a student, because if you're going to tell somebody out there how to live or what, you need to know that. And it's a good idea to know it experientially. So when Peter is talking to the elders, he says to the elders, I don't want you lording it over the flock, but I want you leading them by example. So that's study. That's putting into practice what you have learned. That's not just saying, you know, there's an old saying, don't do as I do as I say. That's hypocrisy. If you're going to tell somebody to do, okay, now there might be times you're going to do that, but for the most part, you should be practicing what you preach. So let the teacher wait on his teaching. Let the minister wait on his ministry. Let the teacher wait on his teaching. Now, the next one is an interesting word, and we shared this. I read it to you from the lexicon a couple weeks ago. He that exhorteth. The word exhort is the same Greek word that's used when Jesus said he's going to send the Holy Spirit. He said, I'm going to send you another comforter, and that Greek word is parakaleo. And that just means one called alongside. So you call this person alongside. So in a way, what the Holy Spirit is, he is God's attorney who comes alongside of you to stand beside you in God's court of law when you're put on trial for your sin, or to come alongside as God's teacher to teach you to minister. And when he says exhort, he's telling you, you need to go alongside. So when Rhonda called this morning, I didn't talk to her, but I can pretty much tell you what she said. When Rhonda called, she asked for prayer for, and then she begins to list these things. She's asking you to come alongside. I want you to get on board with me, would you? Look, this burden I have is really heavy. It's very hard for me to carry this. And, you know, Rhonda is physically ill as well as having these problems. And the same with Calvin. Calvin is physically ill and they've got all this stuff that's come on. Well, they're saying, would you come alongside? Prayer is an interesting thing. Prayer is something people say they will do. I'll pray for you. But they don't necessarily ever really do it. Because prayer is a labor. Prayer is a work. Prayer requires you, first of all, to get quiet. You have to get quiet. You cannot have 9 million things going on around you and your head full of buzzing and pray. You have to get quiet before the Lord. And when you get quiet, you begin to think in a different fashion. So if Rhonda said, pray for, they've having all this car trouble and their trouble with their house and all this sort of stuff that they're, and she starts going through it. Well, if you're just going to pray for Rhonda and Calvin, you're going to have to sit there and think about their condition that you're going to talk to God about, and you're probably going to talk to God about almost like you think he don't know about it. I'm going to inform God that Rhonda and Calvin are having these problems. You don't have to inform God, but the Lord has nonetheless put us in that position. So when he said exhort, he says, I want you to come alongside because this person needs some help. I was talking to Sue about my mom, and when my mom came to the end of her journey, and there still was this thought in a doctor's mind that if they got her over to Shepherd of the Valley and did therapy, that they would strengthen her. She was not going to be strengthened. She had reached that point in time when God was going to take her home. And I thought when the doctor did that, I thought that was kind of dumb. But the doctor had good intentions. So I went over to Shepherd of the Valley, but I never got there when she was in therapy. She was always back in her room. And in her room, all she would do is say, I want to go home, I want to go home, I want to go home, I want to go home. And I would say, Mom, if I could take you home right now, I would take you home, but the doctor has to release you. They won't let you just walk out of here. So I happened to get there, one of those accidents, you know. I happened to get there one morning when she had just gone to therapy. So I went upstairs and I walked in quietly and went over, and there was Mom sitting in her wheelchair, and they brought the walker over to her, and they said, now, Mary, we want you to stand up. And she put her hands on the walker, and she managed to get herself up, but she was bent. She could not stand. And when they told her to walk, she was laying over the walker, shuffling her feet on the floor. And I told the nurses, put her back in the chair. They put her back in the chair. And I said, the head nurse, I said, listen, I'm going to tell you something. You tell me if I'm right. I said, this is useless. She is not going to regain her strength. And the nurse said, no, she's not. Now, I had to come alongside my mom. And then when we took her back down, I said, Mom, I am going to get you out of here and take you home. So I went up and talked to the people and called the doctor. And sure enough, in a couple of days, we had her home. And she lived 1 week from the time we took her home. She was ready to go. But see, when you're called alongside, the exhorter is not always somebody who is this big cheery person who's going to cheer the other person up. It's a person come alongside for some specific reason of giving strength to the other person. Maybe it's legal strength, maybe it's physical strength, maybe it's emotional, maybe it's spiritual. Let he that exhorts, let him do his exhortation. Now, if you have 20 people in a church, logically, at least to me, you should have 20 ministries. If you have 20 people in the church, every one of those people should be doing something, maybe very small, maybe very large. But everybody, because this is a body, everybody in this body should be doing something. Let he that exhorts, that might be one of the more difficult ones, because that's going to take your time, that's going to take your effort, that's going to take prayer time, that's going to involve you spiritually more deeply to come to the aid of another person. Let he that exhorts, this parakaleo, wait on his exhortation, which is simply parakalesis, same word, let him wait on his coming alongside. So in the body, we have these gifts. We have prophecy, and we have ministry, and we have teaching, and we have exhortation. And then he says, he that gives. He that gives. Who got praised the most in Jesus' day for the giving that they saw? The widow who gave her last mite. A giver. People think to be a giver, you have to be rich. You don't. He that gives, let him give. It does not, again, it does not have to be a financial giving, but if it is, he said, he that gives. That means you've been gifted to give. And so your heart does not focus on the accumulation of things. You don't focus on how much I can have, how big I can get, or all that. You focus on how much you can help. And it's maybe a tiny, tiny thing. We were at Doug's last night, and Andy and Weaver, and what was her name? Andy and his wife. Linda Weaver were there, and we were talking, and Andy asked me if we're still doing the school, and I told him yes and all. And so we were going on, and he kind of casually asked me, do the people give you anything? And the answer was no, they don't, except some. There are some who have the spirit of giving, and so they give, but all of them don't give anything. Well, where does it, how do you continue going on? I said, well, because the Lord gives to us. As it happens, God will give to us, and it might come unexpectedly or unexpected, but he that giveth. Well, if you have the different gifts, that means some people are not natural givers. Some people are takers. Some people are users. Some people are givers. Let he that gives give, and let him do it with simplicity. And that's like that little widow. That little widow, he said, Jesus said, look, here's this widow, and she comes up and she has her last mite, which is the smallest coin, the smallest piece of money at that time, and she drops it into the offering and just goes her way. And then the old Pharisee or whatever, he rings the bell and gets everybody's attention, and so they all know that he's given. Jesus said she gave a lot more than he did. So here you have this body, and you have these members. So my fingers have a function, my toes have a function, my ears, my eyes, my heart, my lungs. And I'm doing, on my second book, I start out with little Billy, and I don't mention Hannah's name. I just have this little sister who says to Mom, Billy's teasing me. Billy, what are you doing? Billy said, I drink gasoline. And Mom starts to scold Billy for telling her that she drinks gasoline. And Billy says, no, I didn't say that. I said she drinks gas. In fact, she drinks gases. And then I explained that when you drink two gases, hydrogen and oxygen. And that if you take these two gases separately, they can blow up real bad. But God, in his wisdom, put these two gases together, and you drink it and enjoy the health and nourishment of the water. And the same with breathing. You breathe. Here you're breathing oxygen, and you're breathing nitrogen. And there's other gases, too. But you take these things in on a regular basis, and that nourishes. But if you could take oxygen and nitrogen, you can explode that stuff all over the place. And so Billy's kind of, but at the same point, he's making this point. See, God is so wise, he could take these gases, put them together, and make them necessary and nourishing. And not only can he do that, he can set up a deal between you and the plant world that you will supply the breathing material for the plant by exhaling carbon dioxide. And the plant will supply breathing material for you by exhaling oxygen so that you work together. This is body ministry. See, this is a function that is amazing to look at. And when God puts it in nature, he now comes up to the church and he said, this is what you're supposed to be doing. So giving with simplicity. And he that ruleth. Now, ruling is a very difficult ministry, because you have got to sit in judgment, and we're always told we're not to judge. You know, don't judge, judge not. And so there are some people who don't know any verse in the Bible except judge not or judge. Yeah, you have to pass judgment if you're going to help people. Bob was talking last night, and this is what he does all the time. See, somebody broke the law, and he pulls up beside him and says, that sign over there said 35, you were doing 55. He had to make a judgment. Now, that judgment was based upon his radar gun or his speedometer or something. But those who rule have to make judgments. And the judgments are to be made with the concept of blessing. How can I get the greatest amount of blessing upon these people? Well, sometimes it's by confronting them with that which is against the law of God so that you can bring them into agreement with the law of God and receive the blessing upon them. But government in the church, especially in the small churches, is not viewed much anymore as a legitimate function, but yet it's recorded here. He that rules, let him do it with diligence. That means I, as one of God's servants, have to be very, very aware of the teaching of Scripture so that if somebody that I have a responsibility to is going against it, I can confront them and say, hey, guy, this is what you're doing. This is what you're supposed to do. Let's bring it back into order. And to do it in such a manner, hopefully, because the Bible says a servant of the Lord shall not strive, that you do it in such a manner that it is a soft mercy that is being displayed. And that's the next thing. After ruling is mercy. I don't think it's an accident that the Holy Spirit put those two together. Because there are some people who want to say they have a power lust. If you have a power lust, you should never be in government. Because people with a power lust find their pleasure in the domination of other people. That's why slave masters did not have a conscience about having slaves. They found great pleasure in the domination of, they could hold these people down, they could hold them in an inferior position, they could keep them from any ability to progress, they could make it worse and worse if they wanted to. Because they had this very strong power lust, in that case, coupled with a pleasure lust and probably a lust for things so that they could have great wealth. So mercy always is supposed to accompany government. When you have a ministry of ruling or governing, you should be a merciful individual. And then in verse 9, it says, let love be without dissimulation. And all that means is love should not be faked. You shouldn't try to fake love. You know, at February 14th, the kids in the school all run around dropping their valentines. And you get this pile of valentines. And most of them, today's world valentines, don't make a whole lot of sense. They got some picture of some foreign object on there, somebody zooming through space. But they'll say, be my valentine. You are my, well, what is that? I love you. Do you? How do you know you do? What test have you been put to? We were watching Price is Right one day. This is the only time I ever saw it happen. A woman came up on the stage and she came over to Drew Carey and she said, I love you, Drew. And he said back to her, you don't even know me except from television. And I thought, that was correct. Guys should do that more often on those things. Let love be without, actually love one another. And if you actually love one another, then you have this union, then you have sacrifice, then you have the exhortation, then you have all the other things going together, because love is always interested in the building of the other person. Love is never self-centered. Love always focuses out. It does not focus in. John 3:16 says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Jesus is up on the cross in a horrible, horrible physical condition, and he is the sin offering for the world, and the Father has turned his back on him, and he looks down at those Romans at the foot of his cross who have just crucified him, says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do. Love always extends out. So when a couple come to get married, that's one of the tests you have to make. Does their love extend to the other person, or are they looking at the other person as a satisfaction of some need they have. This person is going to satisfy my, and then fill in the blank. So I ask them a series of questions, and we go through a thing, and that's always my point. Why do you want to get married? We love each other. I say, what if I can prove you don't? Oh, you can, well, let's go through. Well, I might be able to prove you don't love each other, because through the questioning, we find out many times they don't even know each other, and they don't know about, because people have a tendency in a, quote, courtship, end quote, to hide the negatives. They express the positives, but they hide the negatives. So if you bring that out beforehand, then they, when they go to the marriage altar to get married, they have been through all of this, and they have then made the commitment based upon knowing there are some downside things here, there's some upside things here, but I love this person, and I'm willing to contribute to their, whatever, well-being. And each one is doing that. So he says to the husband, love your wife as Christ loves the church. Then he says to the wife, obey your husband or submit to your husband as the church is submissive to Christ, which is saying love initiated, love responding. It's always directed out. It is never directed in. That's why the servant of the Lord, see, he serves the Lord out of love to Christ and out of love to the people. Here's the first commandment, love God with all your heart. Here's the second commandment, love man like you love yourself. So the servant of the Lord is always in that capacity. He never sees himself. He can only see Christ and see the people in their need, and then he serves. So that's a true love. Let love be without a simulation, or in other words, let it be a true love. And coupled with that, he says, abhor that which is evil and cleave to that which is good. And then in verse 10, he says, be kindly, now he's going to get down to the whole body. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love. And then in the King James, it says, in honor preferring one another. But it actually says, you take the lead in showing honor to that person. Don't stand around waiting for that person to show honor to you. Well, you know what? I'm not going to do anything good because look how they're treating me. No, he said, you take the lead in showing honor. Do you know when we have these little children, we have these little five-year-old children and six-year-old children and seven, we have these little children sitting here. We have to every day take the lead in showing honor to them by treating them, first of all, with respect. And we have to, you do not treat a four-year-old child or a five-year-old child like a four-year-old child or a five-year-old child alone. You treat them like a person who's going to grow up and eventually go to judgment. You know what? You're four now, but it's going to be about three blinks of the eyelash and you're going to be 18. So you have to take these little children and you have to lead them but respond to them also in such a way that there is this encouragement that they know. Jacob Hall, you guys know, some of you know Jacob Hall. Jacob Hall has this, we're having to do some work with Jacob. And he came in, this was Thursday morning. He came in and he came up front and he kind of wandered around. We hadn't started yet, we were a little early. And he's wandering, I went over and sat down at the piano and played a little bit on the keys and came up and came walking over here, and I'm watching him, and he come over. He thought he might turn the mic on, and then he didn't. And then he came around behind me, and he gave me a big hug. He put his arms around me and squeezed. I didn't say anything, but I thought, man, that is something. See, it's because we have taken the lead. So that's what the verse means. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love in honor preferring, or take the lead in showing honor. That's not so hard once you start doing it, because people, when you deal with people, there are some people, I admit, you can't do it. But there are most people that you can. We just don't know them. And so we have to find a way to perform that ministry. Okay, that's me for this morning. I quit.